Mollet, Westminster, please. Can I help you?
Hi, I need you to come to my house. My son wants to turn himself in for the Jessica Ridgway murder.
Okay, what's the address?
10622 West 102nd Avenue.
And what's going on there?
Now, he just confessed to killing her.
I know. I want you to tell me what's going on. Can you tell me exactly what he said?
That he did it, and he gave me details, and her remains are in my house.
Did you see them?
No.
Is he there with you?
Yes.
Is he cooperative?
Yes.
How old is your son?
17.
What is your son's name?
Austin Sig.
Can you spell it? You said Austin?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and spell his last name for me.
S is in Sam, I-G-G.
Okay, I understand that you're probably, you know, feeling pretty crappy right now, but I want you to know that you did the right thing.
He did it. He just wanted me to call. He is turning himself in.
Okay. Do you think that he's going to be cooperative with the officers?
Absolutely.
Okay. And I just want to verify you're at 10622 102 Avenue.
Yeah.
Do you think that Austin would talk to me?
Will you talk to him? Yeah, hold on.
Okay.
Hello.
Is this Austin?
Yes, it is.
Hi, Austin. This is Molly at the Westminster Police Department.
Hi.
Can you tell me a little bit about what's going on right now, or how you're feeling, or how did this come about?
I don't exactly get why you're asking these questions. I murdered Jessica Ridgway.
Okay.
I have proof that I did it. There is no other question. You just have to send a squad car, something down here, and
right.
I will answer all the questions that you want to ask,
okay,
or anyone wants to ask of me, as soon as you gotta get down here.
Okay. Austin, I have a police officer that's going to come over to your house, okay? Can you tell me what part of the house that her remains are in?
Underneath the house and across this.
Okay, did you know Jessica before this?
No, I did not.
Are you going to school anywhere?
We're at the Hope Community College.
And you're 17?
Yes.
Okay, Austin, can you tell me your date of birth?
January 17th, 1995.
Okay, I want you to know that you did the right thing, okay? And I do have a police officer that's on the way to talk to you. Okay. Do you have any weapons in your house?
I do, but I plan to use absolutely none of them. I will be sitting in my front room when the police officer arrives. I'll be right next to my mother. I have knives in my room, and we own a few guns, but I'm giving myself up completely. There will be no resistance whatsoever.
Okay. Have you committed any crimes like this before? Do you have a criminal history of any sort?
The only other thing that I have done that before this was the Kettner Lake incident where the woman got attacked. That was me as well. And other than that, the only criminal history I have is a speeding ticket.
Okay. Do you have a car?
I do.
What kind of vehicle do you have?
Jeep Grand Cherokee.
What color is it?
Golden.
Is it at your house?
Yes, it is.
Okay. All right, Austin. Well, I
said the police.
Like I said, I am sending you a police officer, okay? But you have to understand that you know, we take this stuff very seriously, and like I said, you did the right thing by calling.
I would have to hope that you would take this serious, because this isn't I'm over here.
I absolutely am taking this seriously.
Can you please hurry up? I need to call his dad.
Well,
on my phone.
Ma'am, I understand you want to call your husband, and I'm sorry, but I would like to keep you guys on the phone just until the officers get a little bit closer.
Well, how far are they?
They're going to be there in just a few minutes, okay? They're going to be there in just a few minutes.
We can stay on the line, but do you have to keep asking questions?
Okay, no, I don't. Mom, can I just get your name?
My name is Mindy.
Is Austin still there with you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I won't lie, my wife.
Okay. Where are you guys at in the house?
In my room.
Okay. Has Austin been diagnosed with any mental health issues? Does he see a counselor or take any medications?
He saw a counselor years ago for porn.
Okay.
And we were talking, and we think that might have led to it, but I don't know.
And what?
I don't know.
Okay.
I can't breathe.
Take some deep breaths for me. Do you want me to start you an ambulance?
No.
Are you sure?
No. Sure.
Okay, what just happened?
I opened the window.
What's that?
I just opened the window.
Okay.
I need air.
Okay. Mindy, are you sure you don't need an ambulance?
I'm fine.
Okay. Take some deep breaths for me, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and you understand that I am taking you seriously, correct?
I would hope so, yes.
Okay, well, I definitely am taking you serious, okay? Like I explained several times, we're going to, I have officers on the way. They've been on the way since you called. Okay, and due to the serious nature of this incident, like I said, we're just going to make sure, that we get this taken care of the right way. We're not going to hurt you. We're not going to hurt Austin.
All right, we're going downstairs to get some water.
You're going downstairs? Is that the main level?
Yeah.
Okay, and Austin's going with you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Get a bottle of water, Austin.
Okay. And Austin told me he's taking like classes at community college.
Yeah.
Okay, what kind of classes is he taking?
To be a mortician.
He wants to be a mortician? Okay. Mindy, take a couple deep breaths for me, okay?
Yeah.
Is Austin still there with you?
No, I'm hugging him.
Okay, you guys are hugging? Okay, you definitely did the right thing. You tell me when the officers get there. They're coming to your front door. Okay?
I don't see them.
You don't see them?
No.
And you're at the front door?
Yeah.
Okay, they're on their way. And like I said, they're plainclothes Westminster officers.
There's no way here.
And Mindy, I want to say one more time, 10622 West 102 Avenue.
Yeah.
Okay. Are you still at the front door?
Yeah.
Okay. They're walking up to your house, okay? For their safety reasons, they park down the street and they're walking up. Okay, and like I said, they're gonna be plain clothes, they're not FBI. Okay, they're Westminster police officers and they're coming to help you. We're gonna get this all sorted out. Okay.
I don't see them.
You what?
I don't see them.
You don't see them yet?
No.
Do you have a front porch light on or anything that I could make sure that they go to?
Yeah.
Your front porch light is on?
Sorry, what, Austin? What did he say?
Okay. Are you still with Austin?
Yeah.
Okay. What is...
I know.
Are you with the officers or what?
No, they're not here.
Okay. Is Austin still calm? How is his demeanor right now?
I need to hurry up.
I'm trying to get them to hurry, okay? Like I said, we're getting officers there as quickly as we can. Is Austin okay with you right now?
Yeah, he's just getting really anxious and so am I.
Okay.
With me again.
Danielle, can you hear me?
They're here. They're coming up.
They're coming up to the door?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you see the plainclothes officers and their badges?
Yeah, they're here.
Okay, I'll let you go speak with them, okay?
Okay,
thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick. Today's episode is brought to you by Jet.com. For $10 off your first three orders over $35, visit Jet.com and enter promo code TCB at checkout.
All right. Thanks, Dick. Back on October 5th, 2012, at about 4:30 p.m., Sarah Ridgway called 911 and reported that her 10-year-old daughter, Jessica, was missing from her Westminster, Colorado neighborhood. Jessica left her home at 8:25 a.m. that morning to walk to school. At 10:11 a.m., Jessica's school left a voicemail on Sarah's cell advising her that Jessica hadn't arrived at school. But Sarah, who worked overnight shifts, was sleeping, so she didn't get this message until she woke up at 4 p.m. Jessica would remain a missing person until October 23rd, when the Westminster police received a call from Mindy Sigg to report that her 17-year-old son, Austin, had confessed to Jessica's murder. So this is the introduction, is the call from Austin's mother to turn him in.
It's a tough call to hear, to listen to. There's a lot of anguish in her voice.
Absolutely. Now, this confession from a neighborhood juvenile, it really shocked and disturbed the community because they'd been searching for an adult male, probably a pedophile who'd been released from prison, something like that.
Sure.
Maybe someone who's just passing through town.
But definitely they're looking for someone who's been a sex offender.
Yes. But Austin's confession was very detailed and very precise. So Austin identified himself as a monster. Barely out of childhood himself, what led this 17-year-old to commit such a really horrific crime? And this is the topic today on True Crime Brewery, a monster in the neighborhood. What are we having for a beer?
We're having a beer called Tweak. Nice name.
All right. Sounds good.
From Avery Brewing Company in Boulder, Colorado.
Okay. So before your review, let me just thank a few of our 5-star reviewers.
Okay.
Okay. So a big thank you to Jenna Lind, Autism Mom 33, Heather H.H. Green, DMGK1, Gwen 44, Cat Shadow, Tiffany Holmes, Jab 311 2000, Minion 6 Plus, Kyle Sherwin, Z Woman 48, Taliesin R, and Pinkster Cupcake.
Pinkster Cupcake.
I know. One day we need to do an episode just on how people come up with their online names.
Yeah, we'd have to ask everybody.
They're very interesting.
Some are very interesting.
Yeah. Okay, let's have the beer review.
Okay, Tweak. Tweak is an American double or imperial stout. These are stouts that are inspired by the Russian imperial stout. Many are barrel-aged, mostly in bourbon barrels or whiskey barrels, and some are infused with coffee or chocolate. They tend to be higher in alcohol and fuller-bodied with rich roasted flavors. Now, this particular one, this is a beast of a beer.
A beast of a beer?
A beast.
Okay.
It's got an alcohol by volume of 16 to 17%.
That's a lot.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
So it's their Mephistopheles Imperial Stout.
I love that name.
With coffee thrown in.
Okay.
Okay. So I've had Mephistopheles. It's very good. And now I've had Tweak. I got to drink it on our recent trip to California to visit daughter and grandkids.
Yes.
And it was at one of the local beer stores. So I happily bought it.
So you were tweaked. Is that what the beer people say? I've been tweaked.
I've been tweaked.
No.
Not that I've heard, but that's a good expression.
They should start doing that, I think. It's a good idea.
So tweak is a dark brown color. It's got a fairly good sized head with a lot of lace. Very strong bourbon aroma, but also pleasant aromas of coffee, vanilla, and oak. Then the taste is pretty much the same as the nose implies. It's got bourbon, coffee, chocolate, and vanilla. Like I said, this is a big beer. So you're going to sip it, you're going to take your time, even sharing it with a friend, even though it's only a 12-ounce bottle, because it is a pretty big hitter.
That's right. Okay.
So let's open these up and head on down.
Sounds like a great idea. Thanks, Dickie. Okay, Dickie, let's head on down to the quiet end and have our discussion about this really tough case.
All right. You know, I was just thinking, as we're heading on down to the quiet end, it's been almost a year since we've been coming here.
That's right, it has.
Yeah. And you remember when we first started coming here, I was thinking and I said to you that I didn't like this place. It was a little too pretentious and artsy-fartsy.
Yeah, you did. You didn't like it.
Yeah, but I've come to really appreciate it. It isn't any of those things that I had these preconceptions about. I think it's a very comfortable place to be. And I think people recognize us as regulars, and it's just a nice place to hang out.
So you're liking the quiet end.
I'm loving it.
So I might get another year out of you.
Oh, if it involves beer drinking, you'll get more than a year.
Okay, wonderful. Let's go. Bring the bottle.
Got it.
All right, here we go. Jessica Ridgway, she was only 10 years old. She had this cute little gap between her two front teeth. She liked to play waitress and cheerleader with her friends. She loved the color purple. That was her favorite. And like most little girls her age, she giggled a lot. But she was really independent, more than most of her friends. She'd actually asked her mom for an alarm clock so she could get up on her own in the mornings, prepare her own breakfast, and pack her own backpack for school.
Well, see, she's trying to help out.
Yeah.
Because her mom works nights.
Right.
So
that's tough. I've done that. We know how that is. Miserable.
Yeah, the only thing worse than nights was evenings.
Yeah, right.
I hated that more than nights.
Evenings, your whole day is pretty much a goner.
It is.
Right. So raising kids and working the night shift. That's tough.
That's very difficult, for sure.
Now, on the day Jessica went missing, she called a classmate to ask if he was still planning to meet at his house and walk to school with her. And she spoke with the classmate's father, who confirmed that, yes, the two could walk to school together that morning. So she had a plan.
Right. And that's nice, a little buddy system.
Absolutely. I think we all encourage that.
We do.
Now, Jessica's mom said that Jessica left home between 8:25 and 8:30 a.m. She was wearing a black puffy jacket and blue jeans. Her boots had pom-poms attached to them. And she had purple-framed prescription glasses. And she carried a black and pink Disney backpack. Now, it was a normal school day morning. And she liked school. She got good grades, and everybody would say she was just a generally happy kid. So her classmate's father, he was contacted by police in the afternoon when that phone call was made, and he said that he and his son waited for Jessica until about 8:40 that morning. And school started at 8:50, so he drove his son to school when Jessica didn't show up to walk with them.
Now, I don't know if this is being devil's advocate or not, but why wouldn't he have checked? I mean, if he'd already confirmed with her that she was going to be walking with them to school.
Yes.
Or with his son to school, and she doesn't show up, I mean, I would think there's something weird about that. I mean, I just talked to the kid a few minutes before.
That's true. I'm sure that that's something that haunts this guy,
I mean,
I would imagine.
It seems it would have been worth calling her house or something and saying, are you ready? Are you coming?
In hindsight, that's definitely true.
Yeah. Hindsight's always good, right?
It is, yeah. But he drove his son to school.
He did.
Now, Jessica's school confirmed that Jessica hadn't arrived at school that day. Jessica's house and neighborhood were searched. Search dogs were used, but still, Jessica wasn't found. Now, Jessica's dad, he lived in Independence, Missouri. Investigators were able to confirm that he'd been at work on that day, so he couldn't have been involved. Now, searches began on October 6th using law enforcement resources and also civilian volunteers. Areas were searched with volunteers, dog teams, and also teams using thermal imaging devices for aerial observation throughout the area. Because this is Colorado, so I'd imagine there's a lot of wide open spaces, parks, things like that.
Sure.
Yeah.
And they didn't find anything, though, did they?
They didn't find anything. So then, the day after that, on October 7th, a message was posted on a computer message board by a resident of the Rock Creek subdivision, which was located in Superior, Colorado. And it said that a backpack with a water bottle had been found in the area of Andrew Drive and Christensen Avenue, and that the person who posted could be contacted to retrieve it. Now, the water bottle had Jessica's name on it. The person who posted the message didn't connect that name on the water bottle to the missing child, though. So police were called and investigators went to the location where the bottle had been found. Interviews with residents in the area narrowed the time frame down during which the backpack was believed to have been left there, and they had narrowed that down to be between 7 p.m. and 10 p.m. on October 6th.
Now, this backpack is right in plain sight.
Yes, it's right? Kind of neatly sitting upright.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it wasn't hidden or anything.
No, it was clearly meant to be found, I would think.
Yeah, it was.
Now, investigators determined that the backpack matched the description of the one that Jessica was last seen carrying, and inside the backpack they also found a pair of prescription eyeglasses with the purple frames, and they also found her boots with the pom-poms on them. Now, Jessica's mother, Sarah, later identified the items as belonging to Jessica. No big surprise there.
No. And there's some ominous stuff, though. Her glasses are in there.
Yeah, which she would have needed.
That's not sounding good.
No, it's not. But why is it sitting in the open like that? Why does someone want them to be found? Makes you think maybe they're trying to throw off the track of where she really is.
Oh, definitely.
Okay,
and I think
that's what I thought.
The people investigating the case were already thinking that.
Probably, yeah.
So a few days later, by October 10th, a full DNA profile from an unknown subject had been developed from evidence collected from Jessica's backpack. The profile had been entered into the Combined DNA Index System, CODIS. CODIS is a system developed and maintained by the FBI into which crime laboratories can enter DNA evidence for comparison, including evidence collected in cases in which there is no identified suspect. Now we're going to go back a little bit. Back on May 28th in this same year, 2012, at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, a 22-year-old female jogger was attacked by a male suspect on the trails around Kettner Reservoir. This is within the city of Westminster, and not terribly far from where Jessica was grabbed or disappeared from.
Right.
The young woman was grabbed from behind by a male suspect who tried to cover her mouth with a rag soaked in an unknown substance and then tried to drag her into a bush near the trail. The woman was able to fight or scare off her attacker, and she called the police. She described her attacker as a white male, 20 to 25 years old, 5'7" to 5'9" tall, with an average build and dark hair.
Okay, and so we'll find out that these two things were related, of course.
Absolutely.
Right, so the attacker wasn't located, but detectives collected the shirt the victim wore and submitted it to the Colorado Bureau of Investigation laboratory for analysis. From an exam of the shirt, analysts were able to develop a full DNA profile, and this DNA profile was submitted to CODIS, and it later returned a match to the DNA profile from Jessica's backpack. So now we have a pretty good idea that whoever tried to grab this woman is the same person that grabbed Jessica.
We do.
Now, the attack of the jogger had been Austin Sigg's first attempt to kill. From this, he learned that he should pick a smaller victim. He knew the schedule of elementary school kids, and he waited that morning of October 5th for a vulnerable child. He grabbed Jessica less than 1,000 feet from her home. That just blows me away.
That's kind of reminiscent of Eitan Potts, who was grabbed. I mean, he basically came out of his apartment building, walked to few hundred feet and disappeared.
Yeah.
You know, you think, how can that happen?
Yeah, you think if they're there, they're safe, but right. Apparently not. Yeah. Well, he'd lunged from the back seat of his Jeep, and he'd grabbed Jessica, whom he would later say he'd never seen before. He pulled her into the back seat and bound her hands and feet with zip ties. Now, Sig admitted that he lied to Jessica as she asked him questions, telling her that everything would be okay and that she would see her mom soon. Now, he drove around in the Jeep, making random turns for a while, before he took Jessica back to his house where he lived with his mom. He drove the Jeep into the garage and closed the garage door behind him. He carried Jessica upstairs to his room. Then he had her change into a white shirt and black shorts. So we learned this, and the interesting part about this, which was discussed with the psychologist during his trial, was that the black shorts and white shirt made up a very similar outfit to the school cheerleader outfits in their school. So he was kind of dressing her like the cheerleaders at his school.
But she had also wet herself.
Well, I'm not sure about that. That's what he said. And there was some urine on her clothing.
Right.
But we don't know if she did that before he changed her.
Okay.
But that's a possibility. But it still seems that he had this outfit set up for her regardless.
Yeah, I think
he wanted her to put that on.
He was going to change her anyway.
Right. That's.
And he had this outfit selected.
Yes, I believe so. So he admitted to police that he then attempted to strangle her with the zip ties, but he was unsuccessful because the ties were digging into his hands. So that's when he moved her into the bathtub. He placed her face down as he filled the tub with water, and he drowned her. And then with a saw, a razor blade, and a utility knife, he removed one of her hands, and then another hand and a foot. Some of these body parts were cut up and flushed down the toilet. He dismembered the rest of her body and put the parts in plastic bags, and he put these bags in the pool shed in his backyard.
So now we're really venturing into truly horrific territory.
We are, and I'm not going to talk any more about that because it just sickens me, but I think we had to mention it just so people have an idea of how horrific this really was.
Yes.
Yeah.
You need to.
Yeah. So the next night, because of a heavy police presence in the neighborhood, Sig drove his Jeep to a neighborhood north in Superior, Colorado, and he brought Jessica's backpack with him.
So, see, he was trying to divert attention away from his area.
Right. Now, children are abducted frequently, but this kind of abduction with a predator isn't that common, thankfully.
No, you're right.
Right. And we went over this a little bit when we did the Etan Pates case, but let's just review that a little bit.
Sure. I have some child abduction facts.
Okay.
And this is the most recent compilation. About 750,000 children are abducted each year. Now, the vast majority of these cases are resolved within hours. So I think the first thing to think about is that abduction doesn't always mean killing.
Yes.
Most of the time they return. There's three distinct types of abductions. One is by a relative of the victim or a family kidnapping. That's about 50%.
And these are custody issues? Are these mostly
primarily
about custody?
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
Okay.
Then there's abduction by an acquaintance of the victim, called acquaintance kidnapping. That's about a quarter of the cases. And kidnapping by a stranger. That's another quarter. So mostly it's family kidnapping. And this is committed primarily by parents, mostly women, mothers.
Really? Okay.
This is in distinction from the other types of kidnapping offenses, which is more commonly with acquaintance kidnapping or stranger kidnapping, a male perpetrator. But family kidnapping is mostly women.
Okay. But these are the ones that are usually not harming the child.
Right.
Yeah.
This is most frequently occurring in children under 6 years of age. Both sexes are about equally represented, and it most often originates in the home.
So they're taken from their home.
Right.
Okay.
Now, acquaintance kidnapping involves a comparatively high percentage of juvenile perpetrators, largest percentage of female and teenage victims, and it's more often with other crimes, so date rapes and stuff like that.
Okay.
It occurs at homes and residences and has the highest percentage of injured victims.
Okay. So that's why police at first thought that maybe he knew her.
Right.
Right.
Now, stranger kidnapping victimizes more females than males. Most commonly occurs outdoors, both teenagers and school-aged children. is associated with sexual assault in the cases of girl victims and robberies in the case of boy victims, and is the type of kidnapping most likely to involve the use of a firearm. Now, we mentioned that most of the time people survive. Only about 1 out of 10,000 missing children is not found alive.
Well, that's encouraging.
So that's somewhat encouraging. In most cases of abductions by strangers, the first contact between the child and the abductor occurs within a quarter mile of the child's home. There we are, 1,000 feet. Most abductors or potential abductors grab their victims on the street or try to lure them into their vehicles. And the only other thing I'll add is that quick action is critical. 74% of the abducted children who are ultimately murdered are dead within 3 hours of the abduction.
So Jessica's mom was asleep when this happened.
Right.
Which is just horrifying. I don't know why, but to me that's more horrifying to think that you're just sleeping, thinking everything's okay. And this horrible thing's happening to your child, and then you wake up, and it's just horrible to try and think of what she went through.
Oh, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
And there's no, I was thinking, you know, how could they have gotten word to her sooner that she wasn't in school? But, I mean, the school calls and leaves a message. They're not going to keep calling to get confirmation that the child's at home sick or something like that.
No, because I'm sure that happens a lot where parents forget to call.
Right.
But then what about the neighbor? He probably should have checked.
Well, yeah, I find him a little more, maybe not at fault, but just not thorough.
Yeah, maybe not as responsible as he could have been.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a lesson for all of us, I guess. We all need to look out for everybody's kids in ways like that.
We do.
Right? Because he's probably thinking, oh, well, she's not coming, but what would it hurt to just call and check? Might be something to do that we should encourage people to do in situations like that, because never know.
In this situation, yeah. I mean, maybe if it wasn't a phone call beforehand with her specifically saying, is it okay if I come by and walk to school with your son, you'd find a little more of an excuse. But, you know, not too long before she didn't show up, she had called and said she would.
Yeah, that's the thing. If she hadn't called that very morning, sure, but the fact that he just talked to her.
Yeah.
Of course, it's not his fault. It's the fault of the person who killed her.
Well, definitely.
Right. So he was driving with her backpack, and he threw her coat into a random trash can. He also threw away the saw. He later decided to get rid of her torso, and he brought the torso back to the house, washed it, I guess to eliminate DNA, and put it into black plastic bags. Then he drove to an area and discarded the bags.
I think not only the DNA, but just he's got this torso that's probably still bleeding. And so, when he disposes of it, it's a little harder to be found.
I guess so.
Because it, although.
Anyway, you put it, it's really messed up and horrible.
It is.
So he drove to an area and he discarded the bags. Then he did many disturbing things to throw off the authorities. Also some maybe to satisfy some of his sick fascinations with child pornography, corpses, and death. Now, in reference to his attack on the female jogger, Sig said that he had researched online how to make chloroform. So he used bleach and acetone and something else to make chloroform, and he poured it on a rag. Then when investigators asked him what he planned to do with the jogger, his answer was, "Do to her what I did to Jessica." So this jogger really dodged a horrible death.
For sure. So the jogger was like the test case, or the intended first victim.
Yes. And then we don't know if he picked a child because he thought it would be easier, because he also had this thing where he liked to watch child pornography, where he might have preferred children. I don't know.
Right.
So we're not sure.
I think the primary reason was that the adult female fended him off.
Yeah.
And if he's going to make this abduction stuff work, he's going to need a more easily subdued victim.
A vulnerable child. Right. Yeah, right. So during his police interviews, Sig made several comments relating to his thoughts at the time when he grabbed Jessica and forced her into his car. He stated that he was hunting for a victim, and he said that once he had Jessica in his car, he absolutely knew that he was going to kill her. There were no doubts in his mind. And he said that kidnapping Jessica was a result of acting out a sexual fantasy that he had. So he's involved in watching child porn. I think he was actually caught at a very young age.
He was. He was like a 12-year-old.
Yeah.
Which there's some major red flags with that.
Absolutely.
And it wasn't just porn. It was violent porn.
Right.
So.
Very disturbing stuff.
Extremely.
Yeah. Now, on October 17th, 6 days before Mindy Sigg's call to the police, the investigation was getting closer to Sigg as neighborhood canvassing expanded. So 2 days later, a friend of Mindy Sigg called the FBI and actually expressed concern about Austin Sigg. The woman recognized the photo of a wooden cross that had been found with Jessica's body, which was found on October 10th. So Austin Sigg provided FBI agents with a DNA sample and said that he was home sleeping when Jessica was kidnapped.
Yeah, but it sounds like the neighbors viewed him as the weird kid in the neighborhood.
Yeah, but know, kind of a goth and very strange behavior.
Something off kilter about him.
Yeah. So this person noticed a cross that Sigg was wearing and asked him about it, and he calmly answered questions, and investigators left his house. But a DNA sample was sent out with a batch of some other ones. And then on October 22nd, media reports said that a DNA link had been made between Jessica's murder and the attack of the jogger, and Sigg told a classmate that he felt wobbly and tremendously sick that day. He slept in his mother's bed that night.
17 years old.
Yeah, that's a little weird.
More than a little weird.
More than a little weird, okay.
Well, and not just that he slept in the bed, but that she allowed him to sleep in the bed.
Yeah.
I mean, weirdness goes both ways to me.
Okay. Well, the next day he asked a classmate what it felt like to have an anxiety attack. And that night he confessed to his mother what he'd done. So yeah, I guess I keep thinking, well, you know, maybe they're a close family, but you're right, 17 sleeping with your mother.
I would say unequivocally.
It's not good.
It's weird.
It is, okay. I'm going to agree with you. I'll agree with you there.
So what about the DNA sample from him? Did it match?
Well, we're going to get to that, but it ended up getting misplaced for a time, so there was kind of a delay there in figuring that out.
Okay.
Okay.
But we'll talk about that.
Yeah. We'll get to that.
Well, and probably now is a good time before we delve into some more horror to talk about Jet.com.
Right, our sponsor.
Our sponsor for today.
Mm-hmm.
Jet is a shopping site that makes it easy to save money on the stuff you buy all the time.
Who sure can is, that? Right.
So what makes it so easy?
Tell us.
Well, there's a lot of things, actually. Prices drop as you shop. I think that's probably the coolest thing.
I like that.
So the more you add to your cart, the more you can save.
Yeah, it's almost like a video game. Oh, I need that. You pop it in and ding.
Yep.
You save more money. I love it.
There's free shipping on orders over $35.
You're going to spend $35, let's be honest. Yeah.
There's free returns within 30 days. Two-day delivery is the norm. It's on thousands of everyday essentials. Another big thing to me is there's no membership or annual fees. And then there's a 24/7 customer service with the Jethead team in Salt Lake City.
Now, do you have to work for them to be a Jethead, or if you order from them, can you be a Jethead? Because I want to be a Jethead.
I would take it to mean that if you ordered stuff from them, you're a Jethead, because you've used Jet.
That sounds really cool.
Okay. So remember, for $10 off your first three orders over $35, visit Jet.com and enter promo code TCB at checkout.
That's us. TCB. Now,
that's us.
Yeah.
I ordered some stuff from them.
Yes, we both did.
We both did. I just wanted to see how well it would work.
And, you know, what the variety is, because we have some specific needs and wants that not everybody can supply to us.
That's right.
So what did you order?
So this might sound maybe not weird, but anyway, we eat during the holidays a fair amount of tofurkey.
We love tofurkey.
Which is a vegan roast.
Yes.
And our son loves it. We love it. And our local supermarkets don't carry it once the holidays have gone past.
Yeah, and I would like tofurkey once a week. I'm going to be honest. Sure. Every Sunday night, make me a tofurkey. I'm a happy girl.
There
mashed
you go.
Potatoes, some spinach, some carrots. Yeah.
Yeah. And I had looked at some other sites that had tofurkeys, and they were all pretty expensive. But not at Jet.com.
No, you got a good deal.
A real good deal. And so I ordered one, and then I said, no, I want one more. So I ordered a second one, and the price dropped.
Yeah, just so as they said, promised. What the fuck? You threw in another.
So I said, let's go for three. So, and then I bought some Vital Wheat gluten because I use that to make our vegan meat substitute called seitan.
Yes, delicious.
So those were very successful purchases. They came within 2 days, and we already had one of the tofurkeys.
Yes, like so, I said, once a week. So, once a week, baby.
Great place.
Yep. I want to be a jet head.
Okay.
So if you want to be a jet head, what do you need to do?
So if you want to be a jet head, you $10 and get $10 off your first three orders over $35. Visit jet.com and enter promo code TCB at checkout.
All right.
And just one final thing.
Okay.
Terms and conditions apply. See jet.com for details.
Of course.
Right.
Okay. Thanks, Dickie. So Mindy Sig, who we heard her on the 911 call, and I have to say, it brings tears to my eyes. I don't know how good of a mother she was. She might have been a little weird, but it's heartbreaking, the phone call. You have to say that, right?
Oh, can you imagine?
It's just heart-wrenching.
Not only is her teenage son, her only son, right?
Yes, right.
A murderer.
Yeah.
But he's a depraved murderer. He dismembered the body.
Well, when they're calling, some of Jessica's body is underneath their house.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, dismemberment in abductions is about the rarest thing you can imagine.
Thank God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But here it is.
So Mindy, she called Westminster 911 about Austin. She asked them to send officers over to their home. And the confession from Austin was a surprise to the police, but his confession was very detailed and believable, so they didn't have any doubts about it.
Well, and if they did, once they found the body parts in his house...
Well, yes.
That would kind of seal the case.
Yes, you're right. They found the rest of her remains in the home where he said they were. And he admitted to being consumed by a sexual drive when he grabbed Jessica. But he didn't admit sexually assaulting her. Which the psychologist talked a little bit about why that was. And once I explain this a little, I'm going to have you talk about it a little bit. Because I know you have some knowledge in that. So an early result showed that Sig's DNA didn't match the samples taken from Jessica and the jogger. During his interview with police, Sig repeatedly asked about his DNA, and detectives asked whether anyone had helped him. Now, the Colorado Bureau of Investigation tested hundreds of DNA samples for this case. They were obtained by swabbing the cheeks of men in the area, and Sig's DNA had not been matched. But hours into the interview, investigators learned that his sample had been lost in a batch that hadn't been tested.
Uh-huh.
So then they ordered...
So it just hadn't been tested yet.
Yes. So then they ordered an immediate DNA test, and that confirmed that Sig's DNA matched the sample from the jogger's shirt, from the water bottle, and, of course, from Jessica's remains.
There you go.
Now, Austin Sig, he later went with investigators to the location where he had kidnapped Jessica, and he pointed out the exact location where he'd parked and watched as Jessica walked near his Jeep. She's on the way to her friend's house that morning.
Right. And I guess it is kind of a spot that's secluded or secluded enough that you're not going to be seen.
A little bit, yeah.
From houses.
Yes. Now, a search warrant was received by detectives on October 24th for Sig's house. And the warrant also included the search of his 2002 Jeep Grand Cherokee with Colorado plates. And many items were seized. There's 4 pages worth of items that were taken as evidence.
Pretty thorough.
Well, they have to cover all their bases, right?
Yeah.
Now, because Austin was 3 months short of his 18th birthday when he killed Jessica, he was not eligible for the death penalty. But he did plead guilty to her murder, and he told his mother that he didn't rape or torture her. But psychologist Ann Salter, who testified for the prosecution, said that Sig tried to hide what he viewed as the worst offenses from his mother, so he just didn't want to admit to his mother. Which to me is really weird, because you've admitted you've murdered someone. What can you say that's worse, really?
Right. Not only murdered, but then dismembered them.
Yeah, I guess it adds to it as being horrifying.
But I guess rape is not something he wanted to confess to her.
Right. Now, Salter, she testified that Sig was sexually aroused by dismemberment. He'd kept certain body parts, including her skull, which Salter said that he was especially interested in. He also labeled the organs that he removed from her body.
Yeah, but he was studying to be kind of a mortician or something, right?
Yeah, he was in mortician school at the community college.
So he was
studying this stuff.
I guess it's right up his alley, I guess.
Yeah. He actually dropped out of high school, got his GED, and went to do that.
Yeah.
So that's a little bit, well, more than a little bit creepy.
Well, when you're talking about dismemberment of the body and saving organ parts, I mean, that's just, holy cow.
It's really creepy.
It is.
Now, it was way back in 2008, when Austin was 12, that his mother found him masturbating to child pornography on his computer. His stepmother actually took him to treatment, and doctors urged his father to control his son's access to television and computers. Now, Dr. Salter testified that viewing the violent child pornography was just part of Sig's meticulous planning and callous, calculated behavior. By age 16, Sig had developed an obsession with hardcore child pornography and snuff films. He admitted to watching violent videos depicting children being tortured and raped for over a year before he murdered Jessica. Now, many people who knew Austin Sig were aware of this fascination he had with death. He was considered very odd, as you said, by his peers. He dropped out of school in the 11th grade to attend community college to study to be a mortician. Now, you can't say that everybody that wants to be a mortician is deranged, because somebody has to do it. But this young fascination, to me, is very strange.
Yeah, I think it ties in, right?
Right.
You know, here's this kid who's fascinated in certain kinds of pornography, and it just seems kind of a natural progression that mortician school would be something that would get his interest.
Right, right. So he chose not to address the judge before he was being sentenced, and he didn't react when he was told that he would be spending the rest of his life in prison. Now, we want to talk a little bit about pornography and being exposed at a young age. I mean, from what the psychologist said, if you're a normal person, you're not going to be attracted to this stuff. But I guess if you start young, you could get into more and more depraved stuff. You know, you've got the combination of the genetic predisposition and the things that you pick up as you're growing, right?
Right.
I mean, you could probably word that better than me.
Well, I don't know.
Okay.
but you can say, I mean, I think it's a pretty commonly held belief that the younger you are starting with, say, pornography viewing, the more likely you are to have problems with it.
Right.
So it's similar to if you start smoking at an earlier age, you're more likely to have a smoking problem. Or if you start taking drugs at a very, you know, basically the earlier you start doing things, the more likely you are to continue doing them or even to escalating them.
Well, that's what I was thinking about, is the escalation.
Right.
Yeah. Because obviously he escalated to a pretty horrific level.
For sure.
Yeah.
So we know from an article just a year or so ago that consumption of pornography is associated with many negative emotional, psychological, and physical health outcomes. So these include increased rates of depression and anxiety, acting out in violent behavior. It's also associated with a younger age of sexual debut, sexual promiscuity, increased risk of teen pregnancy, and a distorted view of relationships between men and women, for
yes,
sure.
Yes, which he clearly seemed to have.
Right.
Right.
The only other thing noted in this is that pornography use among vulnerable groups appears to be more contraindicated.
Now, what would be a vulnerable group?
Here's a vulnerable kid.
Thank you.
He has, first of all, and I know you'll talk about this, but he's been exposed to domestic violence. His father was a very violent person.
That's true. That's something you found.
And he's living in a single-parent household.
Yes. Well, so, I mean, a lot of kids live in a single-parent household.
I know, but those are risk factors. Those are considered more vulnerable groups.
Yes, but I have to just say, wouldn't he have been worse off staying in a family with an abusive father than with his mother alone?
We don't know.
Well, I think that's something that seems to be general knowledge, that you don't want to keep a kid in an abusive household.
Well, you don't.
They're better off being with a single
but
parent.
He witnessed, I mean, his parents, he was 6 years old, I think, when his parents divorced. And his father has quite a lengthy criminal record. Assault and battery, domestic violence,
Right.
Among other things.
So that can contribute in both ways. He could have some genetic things from his father.
Right.
And he could have some things he was exposed to from his father.
Exactly.
Okay.
So he was a kid you'd probably consider vulnerable anyway.
Yeah.
And then, fortunately, somebody intervened or tried to intervene when he was 12 and caught viewing pornography.
Sure.
And I don't know how much therapy he got.
From what I read, it was very limited. It was a few visits.
Yeah. So, and do we know who made the decision to stop the visits? Or?
We don't. No, we don't.
My guess is that he just stopped going.
Yes, and maybe he was able to play it off like, oh, you know, I'd only done it once and I'm not interested in it anymore. Clearly, he wasn't sharing the way he really felt about it with other people. He was hiding this.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. So it's pretty disturbing.
It is.
How do you know when a kid's hiding something like that? What are the signs?
Tough to pick up.
Yeah.
But just the fact that here's a 12-year-old. This is a preteen.
Very young.
Who is watching porn.
Child porn.
Right. So, I mean, that's, you know, a pretty big red flag.
Now, my point that I was thinking about is that's against the law. So why was he just sent to get help? Should he have been taken to the authorities at that point? Would that have saved Jessica? Or do you think it's just there's no way to tell that young to put someone away would be an overreaction?
Yeah, but maybe if he'd been arrested, there'd be court-mandated treatment.
Right. That's what I'm thinking.
So
maybe that should have been something. I mean, clearly, his mother was trying to help him, or his stepmother, whoever took him to therapy, was trying to help him.
Right.
But it seems like that wasn't enough. So maybe there did need to be more of an authoritarian approach to it.
Yeah, but there wasn't.
No. There wasn't. And then he obviously continued to escalate.
He did. I mean, he was watching some pretty violent stuff.
Yes. So, I mean, that's another good reason to be monitoring when your children use the computer. I mean, one of my pet peeves is when kids have a computer in their room or they take their laptop in their room.
Right.
And to me, that's nuh-uh. Computer should be in a public area in the house where you can see what they're doing.
Yeah.
Because there's just too much on the internet for anyone to be.
And you can put blocks on them too, right?
You can, but that's difficult. I mean, because some things you block and then you might be trying to do, like, from my experience, you're trying to do medical research of something or something for a project and it's blocked because of phrases you use. So there can be kind of an overblocking of that.
Right.
So I think you really do need, I mean, certainly you should block things that you can. You could put childproof things on, but I think you really need to be watching.
Yeah.
I think adult watching.
You have to have kind of a hands-on approach.
I think you have to. I mean, with anything else, like TV, anything, you really need to be there as much as possible.
You do.
Have an adult there.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially after that incident when he was 12. He should have been monitored. He shouldn't have had a computer in his room.
No.
With no one monitoring it.
No, and even if you continue with therapy or don't continue with therapy, I mean, this is something that cries out for being more monitored than it was.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, Austin's mother, Mindy, she was really sobbing in the courtroom as he was, you know, they had the hearing for sentencing. Of course, he did confess, so there was no hearing for guilty or not guilty. But they had the hearing, and his mother was sobbing. And defense attorneys had argued state law required the judge to give him a sentence that made him eligible for parole after 40 years because he was a juvenile at the time of the murder. But the judge overruled that. And at sentencing, Jessica's mother, Sarah, said, "Once we walk out of this courtroom, we will no longer remember his name, only the legacy that Jessica left behind." So she'd chosen to just try to push him out of her mind as much as she could. You know, I think it's the same thing people do when they forgive the criminal.
Yeah.
They don't want to spend their energy on that person.
Exactly.
So they want to spend their energy remembering Jessica as she was.
Is there any mention of therapy while he's incarcerated?
There really wasn't, which is an interesting thing.
Yeah.
Now, Jessica's mother asked the judge to give him the maximum sentence, and she also showed some sympathy for Austin's mother. Now, Austin's own admission, the therapy he received after he was caught viewing the pornography didn't help, and his condition did escalate. It progressed to more violent images of torture and rape. He did have a girlfriend at the time of Jessica's murder, and she told investigators that he stayed at her house one night a week and seemed normal. There was no violence against her. And then his mother, Mindy, said to detectives that her son was gone staying with his girlfriend 4 nights a week. So there are 3 nights a week we don't know where Austin was. So that's kind of weird.
Yes, it is.
I don't know where he would have been. He doesn't have money to have another place to live. What was he doing?
No. And here's a mom that doesn't really have a handle on what her kid's doing.
Yes. Which, he's 17. It's hard to have a handle on a 17-year-old, we have to say.
I know, but I remember...
Especially he's in college.
When our kids were teens, we sure knew what they were up to.
We think we did.
Okay.
I mean, she thought she did, too. But, yeah, I mean, also, do you let a 17-year-old go spend the night with his girlfriend? I don't think I would have done that.
Well, we know we didn't do that.
We know we wouldn't do that. Yeah, right. Now, Austin's sentence included 15 counts for kidnapping, sexual assault, dismembering, and murder of 10-year-old Jessica. He received life plus 86 years in prison. Now, the judge read a statement by Sig wherein he called himself a monster. The defense, though, they tried to show that learning difficulties, his parents' divorce, or even parental neglect may have contributed to Sig's crimes. Testimony by Dr. Salter, who studies sex offenders, confirmed that we don't know what causes one to be a sex offender or to be aroused by violence. So that's another thing, Dick, is there's really no effective treatment known of to prevent this. It's the same when we were talking about pedophiles. We don't really know what to do with them other than to keep them separate.
Exactly.
So that's why I wonder, when a teenager shows interest in this, should they be kept separate? Should there be a treatment place where they should stay? I know we don't have such places, but maybe we should.
I think we should.
We need more treatment. Even if they're never cured, they need to stay there.
That's a common theme from us.
True. Yeah. Also, this psychologist, she didn't think that Sig was genuinely remorseful. So he did make this confession, but she thinks he only made it because he knew he was going to get caught.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
Well, just the stories about how nervous he was, hyperventilating, having an anxiety attack, and knowing that his DNA was going to be linked to the DNA on the two victims.
So it looks like it wasn't really guilt. It was more fear of getting caught.
Fear of getting caught.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
I mean, if he had been told, no, there's definitely not a match, he wouldn't have been coming forward with the confession.
Yeah. So, with the reports that this psychologist looked over on Austin, she said that he had some traits of a psychopath, but she didn't think he was a full-blown psychopath, but that as he aged, he probably would become a full-blown psychopath, although there's no way to absolutely determine that. I guess there are traits you can recognize.
Mm-hmm.
So even though there were these prenatal or childhood factors, even if those were contributing to this sadism and criminal behavior, it really wouldn't matter, according to her, which I can see, because it's not going to make him less of a risk to society if there's no way to cure him.
No. No, the way to reduce the risk to society is to keep them incarcerated.
Yeah, I think that's really the only option we have. Okay. Anything else to add on this case?
Not on this. I guess we should just say thank you for Jet.com for sponsoring this episode.
Okay.
And we'll...
And how do people use our promo code?
All they have to do, this is $10 off your first three orders of over $35. Visit Jet.com and enter promo code TCB at time of checkout.
Okay.
And you've got it.
All right. So why don't we head on over? I just have a really short feedback section today.
Okay.
All right. So when we come back, we'll be in the feedback section. Welcome to Feedback.
So I'm getting to lead off today, huh?
Yes, you go first.
Okay. I have an email from Christine in Wisconsin. This is, Dear Jill and Dick, the finale of Casey Anthony, American Murder Mystery, drove me crazy. Thankfully, George disputed the defense's ridiculous theory that Kaylee drowned accidentally while unsupervised in the family swimming pool. "I don't believe the drowning. That's a bunch of bull to me," he explained. "That's too easy of a story to bring up, because if that would have happened, I think my daughter would have at least had the common decency or common sense inside to call 911 and say something," which we talked about.
I definitely agree with him on that.
And particularly, I mean, George is a former police officer.
Yes.
He wouldn't, if they found her body floating in the pool, they wouldn't try to hide it.
People don't do that. They treasured that girl. At least Cindy and George did.
Right.
He's not going to do that.
So that's to me, just a ridiculous assertion.
Well, I mean, of course we watched this. We were right there watching it, and I was like, hallelujah, George.
Yeah, it was nice to see you got some smarts.
Yes.
Christine goes on, George had been the target of allegations of sexual assault against his daughter Casey during the trial. Now, no evidence was presented to support these accusations, and they are clearly aimed at making Casey more sympathetic and putting the blame on George. George brought up that there were occurrences when Kaylee would sleep for long periods of time, sometimes for up to 13 hours, which raised his suspicions. George says, "I believe Casey gave Kaylee something. Yeah, I mean, that's just my belief," George said. He also claimed that his daughter's friends had access to drugs like Xanax. When asked for the prescription drug street name, he replied, "Zanny."
Right.
Now, I hadn't heard this one before, but that's fascinating, because what did they call the fictitious nanny? Zanny the nanny.
Zanny the nanny, yeah.
So, I wonder.
It certainly sounds like it, doesn't it?
Yep. George goes on to say, "I believe that Casey gave Kaylee something. Kaylee didn't wake up." Okay, fine. It was nice to see that George had gotten some sense and was facing reality. Unlike George, though, Cindy continued to say that she believed in and supported Casey.
I wanted to throttle her.
Yeah. "I don't know what distracted her or what happened," she said. "But as far as being responsible, I feel like it was an accident." So I don't, you know, is that just heavy doses of denial? Or she can't possibly believe that her daughter had nothing to do with her granddaughter's
death. It might not even be denial. It might just be something she's saying so she can try and maintain a relationship with Casey, although I don't know why she would want one.
Right. She believes that Casey's lies to police were a way to deal with the tragedy. "I understand that Casey is her daughter, but how can she continue to deny the obvious? What about the duct tape?"
Right.
Right, exactly. Also, is she okay with how Casey and Jose Baez trashed George's name and humiliated him while he is clearly in mourning and suicidal over the loss of his granddaughter and the realization that his daughter is a monster? Since the beginning of this case, I have sympathized with George and Cindy, despite their enabling parenting choices, but I wanted to jump through the screen and shake some sense into her.
Yeah.
Just like you.
Just like me. I totally feel the same way.
Thank you for all you do. Your Casey Anthony podcast was the most informative show on the topic I have found. See you at the quiet end. Christine from Wisconsin.
Thanks, Christine. A lot of what you said is what I think, too. So I appreciate that.
Yeah. We
I always appreciate people who agree with me.
That's right. They're easy people to like, right?
Yes, right.
But, I mean, she says exactly the same things we were saying.
Yes.
And the final thing, just to mention the duct tape again, was I think the chloroform was to sedate her so that she could put the duct tape on without a struggle.
Yes, I agree. I agree. It's horrible.
But
enough said about her.
Yeah.
Okay, so I have an email from Julianne in Colorado, and this is in regard to the Green River Killer, the episode, our most recent episode. "So dear Jill and Dickie, your episode on the Green River Killer really got me thinking about prostitutes and the difficult lives they lead. Thank you for presenting their lives with compassion and empathy. The movie Pretty Woman, starring Julia Roberts and Richard Gere, came out 27 years ago. It was a movie I loved at the time because I really knew so little about prostitution, the life that Roberts' character was a part of. Then I sided with the idea that a woman can do whatever she wants with her body, and I leaned toward a pro-legalization stance. But since then, I have been enlightened. My enlightenment arose from learning about the data around prostitution, that a majority of adults in the life entered as teenagers, that a majority of those prostituted have had a history of sexual violence, neglect, or abuse, and that most often participation is seen as the last viable means of survival. As Rachel Morgan, a survivor of prostitution and founder of SPACE, a survivor-led network, describes it, when you are 15 years old and destitute, too unskilled to work, and too young to claim unemployment benefits, your body is all you have left to sell. I learned that when laws legalize prostitution, as is the case in some parts of the U.S., Nevada, the Netherlands, and other countries, it doesn't help the health or safety of those in the trade. Rather, it leads to an increase in trafficking, especially that of underage girls, a drop in the age of first entry into prostitution, and an increase in violence against women, not only those working in prostitution, but also against those in the communities surrounding it. Changing laws is not enough. There must be alternative options available, like a social service exit strategy. The U.S. has a third legal structure, that of a criminal view of both buyer and seller, except in pockets of Nevada. The problem with the criminal model of prostitution is that under it, illegal activity flourishes, and the law enforcement and criminal justice system differentially punish the seller over the buyer. Statistics are difficult to find, but in 2010 in the U.S., there were 62,670 arrests for prostitution. 19,480 were men, and 43,190 were women. Note, the majority of those prostituted are women, and the majority of buyers are men. So let's think about what it means to buy sex. The exchange of money or drugs or other commodities is seen as a means of giving consent for the sexual act. What does it mean to give consent when consent arises because of extremely limited choices for survival, or when there is an abuse of power, as in the form of a pimp or other abusive means, such as the threat of use of force or coercion? Isn't that just plain old rape? Keep up the great work on your podcast, Julianne. So Julianne made some great points there, I think.
Well, certainly.
Stuff I didn't know.
The first thing is the totally fictitious viewpoint of prostitution as portrayed in Pretty Woman.
Well,
Pretty Woman.
Ridiculous. I think most of us know that.
Yeah.
But still, it does.
Remember when it came out, it was, you know, everyone was hoping for that happy ending.
Right.
Which
right.
is just total bullshit.
It certainly is. Yeah.
And then the latter part of her discussion was consent, but consent is not consent.
Well, it's not if you're in that position, right?
Right. So you're not, I mean, the simple view is that you're receiving money in exchange for a sex act, and that amplifies consent, but it doesn't.
Not really, because you have unequal amounts of power.
Right.
And choice.
Yeah, and the prostitute has no choice, basically.
No. I mean, when you say a woman can do whatever she wants with her body, that's not something a woman wants to do with her body.
No.
It's not. It's not that kind of a choice at all.
It's no choice.
I agree. And it really put, in the most devastating way, it put the women that were victims of the Green River Killer at risk, because there was nobody to protect them.
Exactly.
I mean, they were just throwing themselves out there at risk with no protection.
That's right.
Yeah. So thank you, Julianne. I thought that was a great letter.
It was.
I really appreciate the thoughtfulness she put into that.
Very thought-provoking.
Okay. So before we sign off for the day, I just wanted to remind people about Team Tiegrabber. Go to tiegrabber.com. You can sign up for as little as $2 a month for our members-only podcasts. And we have a new one coming out every month. And of course, if you join, then you're open to get all of them that have already been put out there. You have access to all of them.
You do.
Our members-only podcast this month is the story of the Whitaker family. Son Bart Whitaker, who set up the murder of his family, ended up killing his mother and his younger brother, and his father actually survived and forgave him. So this is a fascinating story where we can learn a lot about what really makes someone like that tick, who is clearly a psychopath, and also how someone like his father can forgive him and love him even while he's on death row for killing two people he really loved. So that's an episode I really hope some people will join in here, because I think it's a really fascinating story, a story that never leaves my mind ever since I learned about it. It really appeals to me also from the psychological perspective of how can someone live with that kind of deceit, that kind of double life? which is something else that we'll be seeing in the episode we do when we interview Jeremy Grimaldi about his book, A Daughter's Deadly Deception. I mean, it's very similar in a lot of ways how both of these people were leading double lives. Their parents thought they were going to college, that they were certain types of people that they just weren't, and how someone lives like that. Also, we have Shop the Brewery on our website where you can buy yourself a TCB t-shirt, bottle opener, sticker,
coaster,
and of course the almighty snifter.
Don't forget the snifter.
That's right. Well, thank you for listening to this episode of True Crime Brewery, and we'll talk to you next time.
See you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye.